This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Sean Combs, a.k.a. Puff Daddy and P. Diddy. He's one of the most successful and wealthiest people to have come out of the hip-hop world. He started as a record producer, working with performers like Mary J. Blige and Biggie Smalls. In 1991, he started his own label, Bad Boy Records. Several years after producing hits by others, he started recording his own music. He still works in the music world and has an MTV reality show called Making the Band. He also has his own design company, Sean John, and has won the fashion world's equivalent of the Oscar. But he seems especially interested in his acting career. He made his screen debut in the 2001 film Made, which was quickly followed by his role as a prisoner on death row in Monsters Ball. In 2004, he starred in the Broadway revival of Lorraine Hansberry's play, A Raisin in the Sun. The original 1959 production was the first play on Broadway written by an African-American woman. Combs' role, Walter, was originated by Sidney Poitier. This year, a movie adaptation of the revival with the same cast debuted on ABC TV. It's now out on DVD. Let's start with a scene from it. The story is set in an inner-city neighborhood in the 1950s, in a cramped home that houses Walter, his wife, their son, Walter's sister, Benita, who's in college, and Walter's mother. The mother is retiring from her job as a domestic because her late husband's life insurance money is on the way, $10,000. She wants to buy a house with it. Her daughter wants to use it for medical school. Walter, who hates his job as a chauffeur, wants to use the money to become a partner in a liquor store with a couple of guys he knows. His mother is dead set against that idea and overrules him. In this scene, he's angry and frustrated and trying to change her mind. His mother is played by Felicia Rashad.
Mama, I want so many things. Mama, I want so many things. It's kind of driving me crazy.
What is it that you want, baby? You got a nice wife, a fine boy. You got a job.
A job? A job, Mama? Mama. I've been in closed car doors all day. I drive a man around that looks right through me. I say, yes, sir. No, sir. Shall I take the drive, sir? Am I the best trained monkey you ever seen, sir? Mama, that ain't no kind of job. That ain't nothing. Why do I even think you gonna understand me?
Understand what, baby?
Sometimes when I'm driving that man around, and we passing them cool, fancy restaurants, and these white boys, they just be in there talking about things. Oh, important things. They closing million-dollar deals, I know they are. And Mama, these white boys, they don't look much older than me.
So once again, it's money.
Yes, it's about money. Because money is life.
Money is life? I remember a time when freedom used to be life, but now it's money. No. Have times changed that much?
No, they haven't changed. It's always been about money. We were just never allowed to get close enough to see it.
That's my guest, Sean Combs and Felicia Rashad, in a scene from the ABC movie adaptation of A Raisin in the Sun. They also starred in the Broadway production. Sean Combs, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on the success of A Raisin in the Sun on Broadway and on TV. Now, you've said that you understand the character that you portray in A Raisin in the Sun because you grew up with three women in the house, your mother, your grandmother, and your sister. Walter, your character, feels that his mother is still leading the family and that she's depriving him of his chance to be the head of the family, and also his chance to do what he really wants to do, to take the chance that he wants to take. Did you ever feel that your mother was holding you back from things that you wanted to do, or trying too hard to kind of keep you down the straight and narrow?
Unlike Walter, the role that I played, my mother, she didn't do that. So I had to kind of reach back and kind of relate it myself mentally for another relationship of just other people in my life that didn't really have faith in me and didn't believe I could do it. And, the times where I was you know, pleading with them to give me a chance to understand. It was something that I was able to really, you know, relate to other relationships in my life. But no, my mother, on the contrary, my mother was extremely supportive. And being that I lost my father when I was 3, I had to step up, you know, to be the man of the house. And she welcomely, and, you know, she welcomed that.
You are so associated with wealth. I mean, you are, as everybody knows, a very wealthy man, one of the wealthiest to come out of hip-hop. What did you relate to about this scene? And I'm wondering if you aspired to have a lot of money when you were young, if that was important to you.
I mean, what I related to the scene was that, you know, it wasn't that long ago, even though, you know, I've been blessed to have some success, it wasn't that long ago where, you know, I didn't have any money, and my family, we didn't really have any money, and we were just working to make ends meet. So, like, the understanding of being at that place, you don't all of a sudden, you know, lose that feeling because, you know, you've been successful for a couple of years. You know, when I was growing up, money wasn't, you know, everything to me, and I think that's one of the reasons why I attribute my success to the fact that my motivation was to be the best that I could be in whatever I was doing. And I felt that if I did that, then I would be rewarded, and money would be a part, just one of the parts of the rewards of it. And, you know, as far as understanding, you know, where the character was coming from, the movie is about that money is not everything in life, that your family is the most priceless gift that you can have, their support and their love. But it definitely touches on the fact that money is a part of life. That's something that, you know, we can't get away from.
You know, you replicated the stage set of Raisin when you were doing it on Broadway at home during the rehearsal period so that you could rehearse at home on the set.
Yeah.
How did that help you, being alone at home on the set?
You know, for me, it really was that, you know, I was such an inexperienced actor. I was so young in my career, and yet I took on this role following in the footsteps of Sidney Poitier. So it was, you know, huge shoes to try to fill. And so I wanted to, you know, be as prepared as I can be, without having any experience on stage ever as an actor, no experience in live theater. So I always, you know, practice or rehearse as hard as I can. But the thing about working on Broadway, they have unions, and so the unions would kick me off the stage because I would want to rehearse too long. And so then I came up with the idea, okay, if they're going to kick me off the stage, I still have to figure out a way to rehearse and prepare for the role. So I just moved all the furniture out of my living room, which was like the similar size to the stage on Broadway, because the stages are not really that big. And I replicated the stage in my house. So after I would go home from rehearsal, I would still be able to rehearse. And I would, you know, get a couple of my friends from acting school, and I would have them run the lines with me.
So you hired somebody to replicate the set?
You know, I had, you know, I befriended somebody at the stage, and it was, you have to understand, it was a modest home. It was like a beat up couch and,
right, right.
And, you know, a sofa and a coffee. So it wasn't really hard. We just went to the thrift store and replicated it. And, you know, when I'm doing something that I go all out, I'll do whatever it takes to be prepared.
No, your character of Walter is a chauffeur in the movie. Was your father a chauffeur or a limo driver?
Oh yeah, no, my father did at one point. He was he did drive a limo, and then he owned the service. So he had started out as a driver, and he was an entrepreneur himself, and started out as an entrepreneur, and then he wound up, you know, owning the limousine service.
No, I also read that he worked for, that he was associated with Frank Lucas, the Harlem drug pin who the movie American Gangster was based on. That's the character that Denzel Washington played in it.
Yeah, there was a time where they had, I guess they had some dealings together, because my father, you know, he was in the streets, and he was a hustler, or you call him a gangster, and that he chose that life, my family, we've had to pay for that decision, because he got killed when I was 3, so, it's just the way the story goes when you choose, you choose that type of lifestyle. But, you know, I understand, you know, why in his head he was doing what he was doing. He was trying to, during that time, provide a better life for us. And, it was just the wrong decision.
This was in 1972 when he was killed. He was 33. You were, I think, 3 years old. Do you have any that's really early to have memories. Do you have any memory of your father or any memory of his getting shot and killed?
No, I don't really have. I only have, brief, glimpses of, you know, him, throwing me in the air. But besides that, I don't really have any recollection of my father. But I do feel like, because, of the way he lived his life, it kind of ensured that I would live my life this way, the right way.
What did your mother tell you about your father and his death?
When I was growing up, my mother told me that my father had died in a car accident. And it wasn't like she was telling a total lie. She was trying to protect me because we were still living in Harlem. But he kind of did, because he got killed in a car. And I guess that's the way she kind of related to, soften it up for me. So I definitely, God bless her for trying to, spare me the truth. But as I got older, I kind of figured it out, because just growing up still in the streets, if anything would happen to me, like my bike would get stolen, then it would miraculously show up. Anytime anything, would happen, everything would always be taken care of, or whoever was the neighborhood guy that ran the area, he would always tell me that he used to work with my father. So I was like, why does it seem like every gangster worked with my father? So I kind of just put two and two together. And when I got to Howard University, I went to the library and started doing research on my name. And then I saw all of the press clippings from the funerals and the murder and everything like that.
What a way to find out.
Yeah. I kind of always knew, though. I kind of had a feeling. So it wasn't like I was sitting, in a library and I was devastated. If anything, it was a relief that I finally found out. I was kind of upset with my mother for a second. But then, a couple of seconds later, I really realized why she was trying to do it. She was trying to make sure that I didn't, follow in those footsteps. Because, where I grew up at, it would have been a natural thing for me to follow in his footsteps, and also it would have been a natural thing for me to get started, because everybody felt like they owed him something.
Now, correct me if I get any facts wrong here, but you grew up in a Harlem housing project until you were about 12, and then you and your mother moved to Mount Vernon, which is just north of New York City. Compare the two neighborhoods for us.
See, I lived in Harlem, so it's a whole different type of inner city feeling. It helped make me what I was today. It's so soulful. It's a place that's rich in culture and soul and, fashion and music. Everybody is trying to be the best dressed person in the neighborhood. People dance in the streets. You growing up, you in some places, in the suburbs, kids grow up playing Little League and, in sports. And in Harlem, you grow up dancing and singing and in the world of fashion, just trying to, put your outfits together. And so it kind of shaped and molded me for my future. And the difference of the suburbs, it gave me that balance, gave me that other side of things. I was able to grow up with different races and, also get exposed to trees and grass and things that a lot of us take for granted, and being able to really actually play, sports in some grass and not just on the street. And, You know, it was the best of both worlds.
Your mother sent you to a private Catholic boys' high school. Did you want to go to that school?
Oh, no, I wanted to go where the girls were at. But, but she knew that would, when I was a child, I always had loved women, just growing up with women. But, you know, she knew that was probably going to be a big distraction for me. My whole life I went to private school and Catholic schools. I was an altar boy, you know, before, you know, I went to high school and stuff like that. So I was kind of used to the nuns and the priests and everything, and just going to school with that type of, you know, strictness. So I wasn't worried about that, but I at least thought that when I got to high school I was going to get to be around some girls. But that didn't happen. So by the time I got to Howard, and I was at Howard University, and I was finally around some young ladies, I was extremely happy.
You dropped out of Howard University to be an intern at Uptown Records, and you became a vice president in your early 20s. How did you know you wanted to be in the music industry?
Oh, I was, I was looking at, like, the there was two people from that would be in the neighborhoods that really were the guys we would look up to, and that was either the guy, the street hustler, or, the up-and-coming, like, rap star. And so I felt like I wanted to be a football player. I have to back you up a little bit. I wanted to be a football player, but I broke my leg. So then by default, then I wanted to become like a businessman, or, you know, I had a dream to be, in the music business as an artist, or just in the business. And, you know, I would be casted for music videos because I was a good dancer, and they would come into the clubs and they would just come get you out of the clubs and offer you a chance to be in a music video. And I used to get chosen a lot, and I used to always see the recording artist, but then I would see this other guy that looked like he had, you know, more power and more respect and more money than the recording artist, and that was like the owner of the label or the music mogul executive. And so I was like, I wanted to do that. And so that's what I chose. A lot of people chose at first to become a recording artist. I chose first. I was like, if I could become that guy that's there that the music artist is asking the questions of, then, you know, my chances to finally one day be on the stage, I think my chances would be better going that route first.
How does being on stage on Broadway compare to being on stage in front of a very enthusiastic hip-hop audience?
Yeah, it's just totally different. It's just, acting and, being a musical artist, there are some similarities, but to be honest, they're totally different. And the two stages are totally different. At one place, even though there are times as musical artists, we try to bring, you know, a live theater feel to our concerts. It's nothing like, performing on stage on Broadway for, you know, 2.5-3 hours, and you can almost hear a pin drop in the audience. So you can hear every breath that they take. And, performing in front of, like, you know, Wembley Stadium. Because I just don't perform just in front of hip-hop audiences. I also perform, like, in front of whether it's a rock audience, or when I did the Princess Diana concert at Wembley Stadium, that's, like, you know, 60,000 people. It's another level of just impromptu type of freedom and, connection with the crowd, of really trying to get them engaged the whole time. You're trying to, like, pull them in closer and closer and closer to you so you have this eruption. And so in a sense, it is the same thing, but it's just different. So I don't think I answered that question the best way, but it's the best way to answer the question. You understand?
When you're on stage on Broadway, you're in character. You're playing somebody else. When you're on stage in concert, do you feel like you're playing somebody else there too? Or do you feel like you're yourself on stage?
I'm more of myself. I'm not playing like a total different person. Yeah, I mean, a lot of me is on the stage, you know. But there's like maybe 20% that is like just the character that you turn off, you know, when you get off the stage. But a lot of what makes you special, if you're a great performer on the musical stage is if you're able to bring yourself to that, and there's something about yourself that's different than all other performers.
You know, you have all these different names that you've used for different things. You know, you're Sean Combs, you're Puff Daddy, you've been P. Diddy. And so I'm wondering, like, if Puff Daddy or P. Diddy has, like, a different personality than Sean Combs, if you see it as, like, a character in a way.
Yeah, it does. They are. I think we as human beings, we have different sides to ourselves. And I just named all those different sides. It wasn't, you know, that I was. And it was something that with the name thing, it was just like, it's just having fun. It's not, a lot of people ask the question, it's not a serious thing. Like, so I answer to any of my five names. So it's not to confuse you. But yeah, it's definitely different sides of my personality.
Now, your first hit under your own name was about your friend Biggie Smalls, who was gunned down a few feet away from you in 1997. It was a kind of goodbye to him. You were so close. I don't want to get too personal here, but what impact did his murder have on your life, the reality of violence in your world like that, somebody you were so close to being shot in front of you?
Yeah. You know, I lost my father that way, and then, you know, losing him, you know, one of my best friends, and then after that, I lost two more of my best friends, all to the same way. They were all shot and killed. It's a tragedy that, to be honest, this is something that, you know, growing up in the inner city, it's almost like you're prepared for it. It's almost strange when you have a friend who's a black male die of, like, cancer or something. It's almost normal when you hear, when you get the call or you witness somebody or a friend of yours get shot and killed. And it was just as devastating, no matter what it is, to lose somebody that you love. But, you know, the tragedy is that it's almost like a lot of us, depends on where we grow up, it's like we're prepared for things like that. And that's something that I feel has to change in this world.
You know, some people say rap glorifies violence, or glorified violence back in the 80s and 90s. You know, particularly, and that rap made violence seem like the authentic way of being African American. And other people say, no, rap just reflected the violence that was out there. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I feel it was a reflection. And also, I feel like at points it definitely was glorified, but it was a true reflection. But, you know, then It was like, because you couldn't get away from it, okay, well, if I'm in this situation, at least I'm going to be the baddest that was ever in this situation. And then there have been times in the music it has been glorified.
Well, I'd like to play the first hit that you had under your name, and it was an homage to Biggie Smalls and about how much you missed him. It's called I'll Be Missing You. And I'm not sure if it's a sample or just like musicians playing the riff.
You know, it's a sample.
It's a sample.
Okay. It's a sting.
From the Police, Every Breath You Take.
Yes.
So let's hear it. This is my guest, Sean Combs, and you recorded this under Puff Daddy, right?
Yeah.
Okay, here it is.
This right here, tell me why, goes out to everyone. Seems like yesterday we used to rock the show. I laced the track, you locked the flow. So far from hanging on the block of dough. Notorious, they got to know that. Life ain't always what it seemed to be. Words can't express what you mean to me. Even though you're gone, we still a team. Through your family, I'll fulfill your dreams. In the future, can't wait to see if you open up the gates for me. Reminisce sometime, the night they took my friend. Try to black it out, but it plays again. When it's real, feeling's hard to conceal. Can't imagine all the pain I feel. Give anything to hear half your breath. I know you're still living your life after death.
My guest is Sean Combs, Puff Daddy, and that was his first hit. A shout out to his late friend Biggie Smalls. So, you know, in addition to music and acting, you also have your fashion company, Sean John, and your label. And no, I read that your grandmother was a seamstress. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. That my grandmother, she was the neighborhood seamstress. And so when I was growing up, I didn't realize that, that's one of the ways I was going to get kind of my preparation to become a designer. But, you know, I used to, you know, assist her in the house, you know, cut the patterns and, you know, help, you know, press things and get things to be ready to be delivered. And, you know, it gave me a sense of understanding detail and fit on a garment. And I didn't realize that at that time that, you know, it would come to some use as I got older.
You know, it's interesting. I think, you know, like some boys and young teenagers would think of that as being too feminine, you know, anything associated with sewing.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously that didn't bother you.
Yeah, no, it didn't bother me. I've always been comfortable in who I was and, you know, and it was cool with me. My mother, she was making me take guitar lessons, and she tried to get me in some ballet classes and tap dance. So I had to get over the whole worrying about if something was feminine early, you know, with my mother. She wanted to make sure I was well-rounded, so I got past that early.
Did you take tap or ballet?
Yeah, I took tap and ballet for like 2 days.
But you ended up being a dancer.
Yes, yeah, I ended up doing tap dancing. But the ballet was just a little too hard for me. I'm not really that flexible neither.
So, with your grandmother, did you actually learn things that you can use as a designer now, or as you
know? Yes, definitely. She taught me about fit, and she taught me about attention to detail. Just being there with her, you know, the way she was a perfectionist about making sure every garment was perfect.
Did she make clothes for you?
Yes, she made all my clothes on Easter Sunday was made by my grandmother.
Now, the great thing about having a relative make clothes for you is that you're going to have something that's unique. The not-so-great thing is if you want to look like everybody else, you won't.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to buy, like, whatever the popular brand is, it isn't your grandmother's brand.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think that separates the leaders from the followers. And I always wanted to be a trendsetter, so I always wanted to wear something that nobody could get. I always wanted a one-of-a-kind piece from when I was, like, 6 years old, so...
Can you describe one of the greatest things she made you?
She had made me. It was like a navy blue suit with gold buttons. It was a 3-piece suit, and I'm you know back in those days, like the gold buttons used to have the accents, and so yeah, I remember that. That was for Easter. That was one Easter Sunday.
My guest is Sean Combs, also known as Puff Daddy, P. Diddy, hip hop performer, producer, fashion designer, actor, and you've got your own fragrance also. And he starred in the Broadway production of Raisin in the Sun, the revival from a couple of years ago, and that was adapted with the same cast into an ABC movie that's just been released on DVD. The first movie that you made was called Made, and it was directed by Jon Favreau, starred Favreau and Vince Vaughn. And they're two guys who get sent from the West Coast to New York to do a kind of a crime deal that they don't really quite understand. And you're their contact in New York. And I want to play a scene from this film.
Okay.
You're in a restaurant on the phone making business deals when they walk in.
No, man, no. It's too risky. I went out. Listen, man. We made a lot of money on this one together, but it's over. Going down. I'm selling my end. This internet is entirely too volatile. I'm gonna take my block of Microsoft. Yeah. I don't care what problems they having. That nigga Bill Gates is a bad Yeah, and I'm gonna take my profits on Yahoo and all the portal stocks. Yeah, the bubble's gonna pop. All right, then. Peace. That's it? This is Maxie's Calvary? And who the f*** swole y'all up like that?
No one's... Well, we had a thing with each other.
I didn't tell him. He asked me a question, though.
Sit your f*** down.
Thank you, man. It's good to meet you.
If this don't beat all, Maxie done sent me 2 broke swole up guineas from L.A. I gotta hire some local guineas for some beer money. Ain't that right, Leo?
Sure. You boys want anything?
Yeah, bring us 4 Fernet.
4 Fernet?
No, thank you. Actually, I'll have a Strega, please.
What, you drinking the witch after dinner? No class.
Look, there's absolutely no reason to start name calling.
It's midnight. And this motherfucker's ordering an aperitif.
Actually, with all respect, Ruiz, it Strega, that is a digestif.
Strega is an aperitif.
Sorry, Leon. I'm gonna get up out of here, man. What do I owe you?
It's under your arm.
Thanks a lot. Love you, man. If you need anything, you give me a call.
Thanks.
All right.
That was Sean Combs with Jon Favreau and Vince Vaughn from Sean Combs' first movie, Made. What did you learn that you had no idea about from your first movie experience?
My whole concept with my film career has been to surround myself with great, talented people, to work with great, talented people, to learn from them, and to be able to work with these guys is one of the exciting ways to start your film career, because on the set with, Jon Favreau or Vince Vaughn is very improvisational. It's a lot of fun. It's very freeing yourself up and very rebellious. And just being able to work with them and just learn that side of things, and also comedic timing, I was able to learn a lot by working with them.
In the scene that we just heard, you are very well dressed. You have on these great sunglasses, a diamond earring, a fine suit. Did you choose all that yourself?
Yes, I didn't want to do the stereotypical, just the way you saw, the stereotypical, street guy, and so I wanted to, give him a little bit more sophistication and versatility, and they let me do that.
It kind of gave him more power too, I think.
Yeah, yeah, he really is a businessman and wants to be a businessman. And so sometimes he puts on his Wall Street suit on so he could really play the role all the way out. And that's the way I saw the character.
Now, another film that came out the same year as May did, 2001, it's called Monster's Ball. And you played someone who's on death row. And Halle Berry is your wife. I want to play a scene in which your young son comes to visit you in prison. It's going to be his last visit with you before you're executed. And here's the scene.
We ain't got a lot of time. I'm going to give you all my drawings and all my clothes. When you get older, they may fit you and you may want to wear them.
I'm not going to see you again after this?
No.
Why?
I'm a bad man.
Who says?
I do. But I want you to know something.
What?
You ain't me.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not. Everything that's good about me, you're the best of what I am. That's what you are.
As Sean Combs in a scene from Monster's Ball from 2001. What did you do to prepare for this film, to get in the mind of somebody on death row?
Oh, I actually went and I did some research. I went into Angola State Prison and I went to death row and I spoke to some inmates there on death row. And, anytime, I'm blessed to get a role, I do intensive research and preparations. And so I actually went down there and really sat in the cell for a couple of hours, tried to understand the solitary confinement that they're in, and actually being able to talk to the inmates. It gave me a lot of insight on just the world and that the bottom, how low of a point you're at in your life to be there, and how you're trying to hold it all together. But, you're just a second away from breaking. And, it was definitely something that was, it was sad, really, getting the information and doing the preparations. And the scenes were very, they were very sad scenes, Even when I look back at them, just to be able to have to sit there and talk to your son before you know you're going to die and you know that you've, made a grave mistake.
You're actually shown being electrocuted in the film. Yes. And, you're strapped to the electric chair and your body, convulses.
Yes.
As you're electrocuted. Tell me about shooting that scene.
Shooting that scene was extremely eerie because everything was real. So the chair that I was in and the things that were on my head and everything that was there were what they actually used in the way, you know, the things they actually used to electrocute people and to kill them. And so none of it was props. And so you could actually, in a sense, you know, it felt kind of eerie. You could feel almost like the spirits there. And, you know, I just used it. Instead of getting scared, I just used it to channel the situation and make it realistic. And a lot of people say that was my best scene. So I said I could always, at least we know that I could get electrocuted the right way. I had to tell people that wasn't a stuntman or a double. That was actually me. So, but you know, yeah, it was that realistic, though, that people asked, was that, you know, was there some sort of trickery with that? No, that was really just me really acting out the way I felt it would feel. You know what I mean? And even just have the director yell cut and to take the mask off and see everybody's faces and see them looking at me and see, like, they were, like, you know, the feelings they were going through was really real, you know?
Well, just one last question. How much sleep do you get a night?
I would say like 5 hours, 4 hours.
Can you run on that? I mean, do you have insomnia, or you're just too busy to sleep?
Yeah, no, I have insomnia. Then, you know.
But so you put when you can't sleep.
No,
put
I don't.
That to
I don't have insomnia.
You don't have insomnia. Okay.
You got to watch what you say. So I don't have insomnia. I don't want to put that out on that. I'm going to change that up. I don't have it anymore. It just got cured today.
Hey, congratulations!
thank you very much. I don't have insomnia anymore. Tonight I'm going to sleep great.
Good luck. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Sean Combs starred in the recent ABC movie adaptation of A Raisin in the Sun, which is now out on DVD. The war in Iraq has inspired an unprecedented number of movies of all kinds, in particular documentaries about everything from torture in Abu Ghraib to heavy metal fans in Baghdad. A new documentary by Nina Davenport called Operation Filmmaker approaches the war from a vantage point largely outside Iraq. It's the story of a young Iraqi who leaves his country in hopes of becoming a filmmaker. Our critic at large, John Powers, has a review.
If there's one clear cultural lesson to be drawn from the war in Iraq, it's that people don't go to movies about an ongoing war that isn't going particularly well. So I feel slightly perverse in telling you that there's a new film about Iraq that you might really enjoy. It's a documentary called Operation Filmmaker by Nina Davenport, and the first thing you should know about it is that it's not grim or hectoring. It is, in fact, a comedy that would have been appreciated by Billy Wilder or Luis Buñuel. It shows what happens when the very best of intentions bump into the untidy reality of living human beings. The story begins in 2004, when the actor Liev Schreiber sees an MTV item about a Baghdad film student named Mutana Momed, who's burning to make movies. Schreiber's about to direct his own first film, Everything is Illuminated, and in a burst of generosity decides to invite the 25-year-old Shiite to the Czech Republic to work on the production. In what proves a burst of canny intuition, he also invites Davenport to make a film about the young Iraqi's experience on the set. At first, everything is great. Schreiber goes to the Prague airport to pick up Mutana, who's obviously delighted to be there. But almost instantly, the rose loses its bloom. Even as Mutana feels insulted by what he's asked to do, he's instructed how to properly stir the trail mix for one of the film's vegan producers, Schreiber and company feel let down by their protege. Rather than behaving like an ambitious young American filmmaker who'd do anything to ingratiate himself with the bosses, Mutana strikes them as, well, difficult. By turns prickly and mocking, he blows off assignments, bubbles with resentment, and makes people feel guilty. To top it all off, he doesn't even agree with them politically. Here, producer Peter Saroff talks to Mutana about the strange politics of their situation.
When Liev and I first started talking about the idea after we saw you on MTV, and, you know, we talked about such sort of high concept things like, well, this idea that we're making this movie about young people connecting over a cultural divide. And like the experience of these two American Jewish guys who are here to make a movie with an Iraqi man, there's a cultural divide that we have to cross. And here I am, this, like, you know, left-wing American in terms of my politics and all this stuff. And, you know, and so I have to confront this idea that, like, you weren't opposed to the war. So anyway, so then when, and this is coming out in Entertainment Weekly tomorrow, so that I say, some, I'm quoted as saying, you know, we had this idea, blah, 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 but I never imagined that Mutana would ever say to me, I love George Bush, he changed my life.
I love George Bush.
Mm.
You're
disappointed.
No, not at all. I'm not disappointed. You know.
In fact, everyone is disappointed. And as the story progresses, you start to realize that Operation Filmmaker isn't just a movie about a young Iraqi filmmaker. It's a sly parable about Operation Iraqi Freedom and how the occupation went wrong. What makes this portrait of star-spangled naivety all the slyer is that it centers not on neoconservatives who championed the war, but on showbiz progressives who opposed it. Good liberals, Schreiber and Seraph clearly have a fantasy of saving the young Iraqi and putting him on the way to a life like their own. But just like Iraq itself, Mutana has his own dreams, limitations, and history. Even as he expects too much too soon, he clearly wants to be handed overnight success and prosperity. He knows that if he returns to Baghdad, he may well be murdered. And so while Mutana keeps hustling for dear life, his rescuers clearly can't wait to get him off their hands. The one with no exit strategy turns out to be Davenport, who was supposed to merely be documenting Mutana's experience, but winds up being sucked into it. Eventually, the two get caught in a cycle of mutual exploitation. Without Mutana's cooperation, Davenport won't have enough footage to complete the film. She'll have wasted many months and lots of money. Of course, he knows that, and so he begins demanding her assistance, some of it financial, to keep letting her film his life. While their Apache dance is itself a metaphor for the occupation, it also offers a valuable corrective to our ideas of nonfiction filmmaking. Most socially conscious documentaries encourage us to think two slightly contradictory things. First, that we're watching unadorned life through the eye of an impartial observer. And second, that this impartial observer is implicitly a hero, because he or she self-effacingly cares enough to show us the life of the poor, the unhappy, the struggling, and the lost. Davenport's movie puts the lie to all that. As she dickers with Mutana to keep him on board the project being a record of his own precarious life, we're reminded that every documentary comes larded with agendas and negotiations. In its amusing way, Operation Filmmaker demonstrates that the idea of a clean, heroic, objective documentary is as much of a fantasy as the notion of saving a country with a quick, easy invasion. In the real world, even the most benevolent-seeming relationship can easily become a quagmire.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. He reviewed Operation Filmmaker. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.